business of television is becoming more difficult. I think, like all aspects of our economy, as the economy goes south in terms of finances and available revenues, it becomes more difficult to do the job that we all did very successfully for a number of years. Unfortunately, the Irish television business is heavily dependent on commercial revenue. Commercial revenue has dropped in all shapes and forms, not just in television, but in radio and print. The amount of money spent on advertising in the economy has gone south. So it is more difficult. And I think as creative independent producers, we have to become creative on the business side as well, not just on our content. I suppose when we first set up Shine a Will, we've always worked with brands. We've created shows for brands from the get-go. So we were always very comfortable working with commercial brands to make TV shows that were for the brands or working with the brands or to embed the brands around the shows that would give them value as advertiser-funded programming. Post the change in the EU regulations on product placement, I think there's a more opportunity for brands to embed themselves more in programmes. And I think it all has to be done tastefully. It has to be done in conjunction with the advertisers, and it has to be done in conjunction with both broadcasters and the advertising sector, but also in a way from a consumer point of view that the enjoyment that you set out to do in the first place is mitigated by just commercial messages. I think people have to understand that commercial television was created, you know, in the 50s, right back when television itself first evolved, and it was primarily funded through spot advertising. The world has changed, so we have to look at a new model of funding television. No longer can you get the same value out of traditional spot advertising because of the proliferation of channels, number one. And now with technology, people want to watch programmes when they want to watch, on devices that they want to watch at a time of their choosing, and they can edit out the advertising breaks through technologies like TiVo and Sky Plus, etc. So we have to be aware of that and accommodate the advertisers in a different way. Product placement happens to be one way of doing that. There are other ways, sponsorship and other means. And I think we constantly have to look at how we do that. And advertising is not a dirty word. People seem to have a problem with product placement, but yet I'm not aware of where any product placement has actually harmed anybody. In actual fact, it's enhanced the ability to make programmes. I think you have to be cognizant of the main rules that, you know, the advertisers can never have editorial control of the programme. That always remains with the broadcasters and the producers. And you can't have undue prominence, and you have to make sure that you don't contravene the, I suppose, the editorial makeup of a programme just to bring a brand in. But you can very successfully bring a brand in. Spar have very successfully branded the shop in Fair City, and there are many other ways of showing how it can work. We created a funding mechanism for the Irish version of The Apprentice, which is modelled primarily on how they produce The Apprentice in the States. And The Apprentice was a show which was of its time. It was created by Procter & Gamble with Mark Burnett, where Procter & Gamble realised that their value of their spot advertising was reducing. So instead of spending their money in the commercial breaks, they wanted to spend their money in the programmes. So they actually created The Apprentice to put Procter & Gamble products on screen in network television. It's been hugely successful, and it's running now in excess of 7 years in America. And we just took that model, had to adapt it to the regulations here in Ireland. So it's primarily sponsorship driven. I think there's a lot of brands and a lot of advertising agencies have yet to embrace, I suppose, the notion of product placement. So it's a new medium. It's a new way of looking at spending your advertising budget, same as spending it in digital or spending it in print or other forms. And I think until it's fully embraced by all, nobody's going to see the full value. But it's something that we've looked to do to replace traditional revenue streams. TV3 as a broadcaster just have limited resources through their ability to have a limited share of the available commercial revenue. So we all have to think differently and maximise whatever resources are out there. I think from an independent producer's point of view, we've had to change the way we do things. I always say to people that there's an old expression, there's no business like show business. And in that expression, well, there's only one show, but there's two businesses. So as a producer, I end up being more a business owner and operator. And I think that's an important thing to understand, that if people are looking at getting into this business, it is first and foremost a business. You need to watch your cash flow. You need to watch where you're going to get your revenues to make your products. And then you've got to sell your products. So it's not, it doesn't stop when you've made the program. How are you going to slice and dice the rights? How are you going to make sure that there's a life beyond the airing of the program? Because you're only making a moment in time. Can you find new markets, new customers? So you're constantly looking to business develop. And I think that's the future. It isn't going to go away. In fact, there's going to be an even greater proliferation of customer base. We may end up actually making programs that will be paid for by the individual viewers as opposed to an aggregator that's called a broadcaster. I think the way we actually consume television will change. I think people will need to be more aware of the fact that television will be consumed via a browser rather than traditional cable or satellite broadcasts, linear models. So I think the key is going to be the program. The program will be king. The title will become brands in their own right, and people want to follow their own brand, their own favourite, and they'll watch it wherever they can get it. And if you want to have a future as a content maker, you want to make sure you're building a very successful brand that can be sold to as many people as possible through as many means as possible. So the ownership of the actual underlying rights is going to become even more important. And as a creative program maker, we would see ourselves as the original rights holders. And I think the ongoing relationship with our customers, be it a broadcaster or an end consumer, is going to evolve and change. But the main thing we want to make sure is that we have a future for our rights and that we can get new markets for our rights. There's always been an issue with program makers and broadcasters in terms of rights, and I think it's an evolving process. In 2003 in the UK, Tessa Gell, the Culture Secretary, introduced a new act, the Communication Act, which turned the rights issue on its head. It took the rights away from the broadcasters and gave them to the originators, the producers. What actually happened was the independent production community became a very big force for commercial good in the UK economy. And in fact, it's a huge contributor to the UK economy and is one of the biggest sectors in the UK economy now. The global value of international television secondary markets is in excess of $6 billion. It is dominated by English language, mostly from the US. But the UK contributes nearly a third of that. So it's a huge market, and that's a huge commercial gain for the UK. That didn't exist before 2003. There were small elements of it, and certainly small-scale impact on the global market. But now it's in fact the graph is completely switched in terms of market domination by an individual country in favour of the UK in terms of its size and scale. I would like to think that Ireland can play its part. We've long been a country where we've exported literature for centuries and been well-renowned. We punch way above our weight in our export of music and other cultural endeavours. Why not television? And I think we're standing at the very start of an explosion in Irish cultural exports through television products. All it'll require is a new way of thinking. We're certainly trying to do that in our company. And I think the broadcasters are a little more enlightened. The regulators have to change as well and get the regulation framework in vogue with the rest of the industry. There's no point in one entity owning all rights and then sitting on the rights and doing nothing. That's a waste of all of our endeavours. And in a country that has to reinvent all its economic models, I suppose, to create more indigenous wealth in the country, to become less dependent on inward investment and find businesses that we can invest in and make export businesses, television is a very good opportunity for Ireland Inc. And I think things will change, and I think the broadcasters will work with producers. And broadcasters need to look at the UK example and see that they didn't disappear out of existence. The BBC is a bigger organisation now. It's a different business model than it was in 2003. Same with Channel 4, Sky and ITV. And their business models are evolving every day and every year. And I think the business models will evolve here. And I think there's opportunities for Irish broadcasters to share in those rights exploitations. So it shouldn't be just one way where all the rights go to the producers and they get all the benefits. The benefits have to be shared. A programme that doesn't have a broadcaster in the first place isn't a programme, it's an idea. In the Irish case, the commissioning broadcaster will tend to require all broadcast rights and non-broadcast rights as part and parcel of their ownership of the project if they are going to be fully funding the project. So in the case of RTE, they have a terms of trade that's agreed with the supply chain, which is the independent production sector, which pretty much sets out what rights that they will want in the project. And those rights have remained fairly static over a number of years, where most of the rights were vested with RTE as the key funder. Our independent sector would look to the UK model to have it more in line with the UK model, where the rights would actually rest with the originating producer and the broadcast rights would then be given to the broadcaster. And I think there has to be a recognition of a sharing of other rights, because if the broadcaster don't get involved and don't have the broadcast rights, the other commercial rights are pretty much worthless and won't have a secondary market. So it's a very much a related relationship, but it's in everybody's interests. I fundamentally think that broadcasters are broadcasters, and their business is understanding the business of broadcasting and how to maximise that. And that's a very complicated business to understand, how you run a broadcaster, how you protect it in the future, how you bring in your commercial revenue, how you satisfy your consumers and your listeners and viewers. And to organise and do all of that successfully is one business. To, on the same hand, also understand the global marketplace for content, that's a different business and it does require different skills. And I think the people best positioned to maximise that are the people with the fire in their belly to get out and meet the market. And independent producers have got very good relationships right around the globe. We are a globally owned entity, that is, the majority shares are held here in Ireland, and we're looking to grow that business with other relationships, with other broadcasters and producers right around the globe. And I think that's the business of the creative side. We'll always have the ability to network and generate partnerships that can stretch right around the globe and maximise the returns for all investors. I think the independent production sector in Ireland is going through a phase where, because of the pressures on all the broadcasters in terms of their revenue streams and then their ability to fund, because what you don't get in, you can't spend at the other end. And, you know, it's well publicised, the pressures that TV3 are on, their commercial revenue is down. TG Cahir, who depend on the Exchequer for their funding and small commercial revenue, again, they're working with a lesser amount to spread around the same supply chain. And RTE, whose licence fee hasn't increased in a number of years, the commercial revenue has decreased, and substantially so. They're learning to work with less, therefore there's less money to make programmes. I think the independent sector is at the bottom of that chain, and they're struggling. We have had to reinvent our commercial model. We've had to be very creative how we fund our programmes. We've got to be creative both internally in terms of our production management of scarce resources and how we apply our skills, and we take some of our expenses from the making of the programme, whether it be on the actual shooting and producing to the post-production and editing. We're bringing some of that in-house. We're upskilling young graduates to be multi-skilled. And then the other end, in terms of the actual funding, whilst we can get a percentage of our funding from the broadcaster, we're bringing percentages from our commercial contracts with commercial sponsors and advertisers. So everything's changing. And then we're taking our finished programmes and we are looking to exploit them in other markets and get some revenue streams from that as well. The fact remains that a lot of television programmes and a lot of radio programmes are now consumed on non-broadcast services. A lot of programmes are now consumed in catch-up services, and a lot of programmes are consumed in the sell-through or DVD or in mobile phones. There's so many ways that people can consume what was a previously described broadcast programme. So is a broadcast licence fee the correct term? Should it be a fee that's collected on screens if they're sold in a country, or recording or other devices? So if you buy a radio, should it be a contribution towards a licence fee? Fundamentally, I believe there has to be a licence fee. If we as a state want to continue to have an independent view of the world, well, then we need to have an independent view on programming. We need to have Irish voices on Irish radio stations. We need to have Irish voices on Irish television programmes. And if we don't want to have our cultural remit that comes from right around the globe, except Ireland, the next generation of Irish people coming up will consume programming from right around the world, and they will, because it'll be there. suddenly we will have a much more, I suppose, globalised, homogenised view of the world. And that's not necessarily in the Irish interest. It's certainly not in the interest of the Irish body politic or our cultural reference points. You know, the founders of the nation of Ireland in 1916 were all from a cultural background, and they all wanted to protect what was Gaelic in its nature. And if we're going to have a future for a Gaelic state, well, then we have to invest in our cultural exports and our cultural reflections of life and Irish stories. So we have to have public resources to do that. And we as a nation have to decide to continue to pay for it. So a licence fee may change in its structure and makeup, but I think we have to have one. In fact, I think it's too low and we should pay more. You have to make a decision on where resources can be spent. You can open up the argument into, is it spent exclusively with exclusive broadcasters? And do you describe the people who receive the licence fee as public service broadcasters? Or do you break it up into a smaller definition of public sector programming or licence fee funded programming? And I think there's room, as it is in Ireland, we already have a situation with the Irish licence fee that it's spread amongst broadcasters through the BAI Sound and Vision Fund, which top slices the licence fee and spreads it with commercial broadcasters and public broadcasters, both radio and television. So it's not the perfect model, but at least it spreads public money around all broadcasters. I would like to see the public money also have the criteria of being spent on programming that is relevant to the audience. And I think it's hugely important that the public, if the public are funding programming, the majority of public must see that programming. And I think whilst there's space for minority programming in all schedules, we need to be careful that not all public funding goes exclusively to minority programming. And that's a very important point. I think what defines a public broadcast schedule needs to be understood, that if all of the people are funding the whole schedule, the majority of the funding should go towards the most populous programmes in that schedule. And you need a full mix. So you need a schedule which has programming for all tastes and all desires and all demographics. So you need big entertainment shows, you need small entertainment shows, you need high-end documentaries, you need quality drama, news, current affairs. You need the full gamut if you're going to have a healthy schedule that the whole nation will watch. If you don't, you'll start rapidly becoming a broadcaster with a schedule that will only appeal to a section of the populace. And that's not in the interest of the public, and it's certainly not in the interest of the people who are paying the licence fee. So it's a complicated question, but I believe that fundamentally we as a nation, we either want Irish content or we don't. And that's the simple question. If we say yes to Irish content, we've got to pay for it. But I think how we pay for it will change over many, many years. You know, television formats have existed for many years. The definitions of different types of television has evolved. So the term reality seemed to arrive maybe 10 or 15 years ago, probably with the invention of Big Brother as the first major reality format. But in actual fact, reality television has been around since television first was born. You know, I think it's actually the wrong phrase. I think factual and non-factual programming is the clear definition. It's either a scripted idea or it's a non-scripted factual program. So even the news has a script, but it's dealing in the news of the day or the facts of particular parts of the day. So I don't like the expression reality programming, because it seems to have a definition which is negative. It seems to have a definition which is that it's cheap, and it's not. Some of the shows that are described as reality programming are some of the most expensive shows on Irish television and global television. So I think the definition is wrong. That's the first thing. Is there going to be more of it? I think, again, like any part of television, everything evolves and everything will change and everything will find a different place. Talent shows will remain as part of television schedules, but they will change and they will evolve, and they will have seasons where they're popular and seasons where they're not. I grew up in a house where new faces and opportunity knocks were clearly part of the highlights of the programming schedule that week in the 60s and 70s. I'm showing my age now. Pop stars arrived in 1998 as a new form of a talent show, but it was just a talent show. That has morphed and changed into both Pop Idol, X Factor, Fame Academy, and now The Voice. So it keeps on evolving, and I'm sure it will evolve. MasterChef is a show which we produce, which is described as reality TV. I would describe it probably more correctly as a factual entertainment series based in the world of cooking and cuisine. Yes, it's a reality show because everything that happens is real. We do not put words in people's mouths. We do not give the contestants a script to follow. They're given a task to do. Similarly, in The Apprentice, it's described as a reality show, but again, it's a show which was evolved into a need to put brands onto network television and place, I suppose, a quest and a narrative structure within a show that tested people's ability to do business tasks. So all types of television is going to evolve. I think it's important for people to understand that what is perceived as cheap isn't necessarily so. There is a part of television which I believe is an area which we are going to see more of because of the disappearance of revenues, and that are these, what I would describe more correctly as the semi-scripted reality shows, whether it's California or whether it's The Only Way is Essex or Jersey Shore, all these shows which have the blurring of real life and scripted life. And I'm not sure if it's a great place for the future of television, but as television schedules become longer, hungrier, and the need for content is growing and the resources fall, unfortunately the resources to spend on the programming is also going to fall, and that's where these shows have grown out of. But I think one of the things I'm seeing from the international marketplace is that quality and high end is coming back as people invest in technology like higher definition, 3D, high quality factual shows, high quality drama are actually making a bigger impression than low quality cheap shows. And maybe what's actually happening is people are finding more time to invest in the higher quality programming. And I actually think it'll turn. And I think the schedules that have the higher quality will have more audience. And therefore, these lower quality shows will probably disappear. They'll evolve and they'll come back in a different form when there's a need to fill a different gap. I think we all have to be aware that we're working in a world that'll forever be evolving. There's always going to be a place for different reflections and mirrors to life. And as life changes and as society changes, people will have different ways of recording and telling their story. That's a fact of life, whether it's on television or in a radio program or on the newspaper or magazine. That will always change. If you pick up a newspaper today, it will reflect different stories from 50 years ago. If you pick up a newspaper from 100 years ago, it'll tell you a different story. But they were all true and of record at that time. And it's the same with television. It will just continually change. And I do believe there is a place for, if an audience wants it, there's a place for it. But the audience will ultimately decide what they want to watch. Sometimes the audience have to be sort of pushed and gathered like sheep on a mountain to watch something. And I'm a big believer in if you build it, they will come. So if you can create something that's good enough, people will watch it. Maybe if you can create something that can make a big enough noise, people will watch it. But probably not for very long. And then they'll want something a little bit more depth, a little bit more entertainment value and or quality that they want to come back for more. So for me, quality will always out over the value a program is in terms of cost per hour, etc. When The Apprentice was first produced by us, product placement had yet to become a part of the regulated framework. So we had to work within the existing regulatory framework, which allowed for sponsorship of programming. Unusually, what we were able to do is create a funding model based on sponsorship, which didn't just have one sponsor on a series. we had individual sponsors of episodes. And that's how we got over the inability to bring different brands in one sponsorship package. Now, working hand in glove with sponsorship, we interpret the product placement regulations to allow brands where they want to have product placement, if that can be achieved through the particular tasks that are on. There's an element now of part of our deals are sort of mixed sponsorship with product placement, and vice versa. Some product placement payments we get have nothing to do with sponsorship at all, and they're purely because somebody has paid to have their brand or products featured in the show. That's the difference in the way we fund it. So it's a little bit of both. I think the biggest barrier to more in-depth product placement is, I suppose, from the brand's point of view, their understanding of what is product placement. From the advertising sector's point of view, it's for them to understand that product placement is not a dirty word. It shouldn't be something that comes along and takes away their previous business. I think product placement will only work in tandem with existing advertising and other marketing tools. So if you took your budget for selling baked beans and invested it now only in product placement, it probably won't be as successful as if you took a portion of your marketing stroke advertising budget and invested it in product placement along with your underlying brand support in traditional advertising in all media. Interestingly, we're finding the linkage that is really working now, rather than product placement sponsorship, it's traditional television and digital, where brands now want to talk about their brand in a program, but then interact with the brand in a digital form. So an awful lot of the shows we're working on now, whether it's MasterChef, Dragon's Den or The Voice, what we're doing now is we're linking editorial content into a digital environment where the viewer or listener can interact in a meaningful way with the content and the program through social media and other means. And by doing that, we're connecting brands with consumers in a more wholesome way, and allows people to touch and feel a brand that you previously couldn't do in a one-dimensional or a two-dimensional commercial.